It's been a while, hasn't it? Good morning, everybody. I am Art Bell, and this is The Weekend. Richard C. Hoagland is a former Space Science Museum curator, a former NASA consultant, and during the historic Apollo missions to the moon, was science advisor to Walter Cronkite and CBS News. For over 20 years, Hoagland has been leading an outside scientific team and a critically acclaimed independent analysis of possible intelligently designed artifacts on Mars. Richard and his team's investigations have been quietly extended to include over 30 years of previously hidden data from NASA, Soviet, and Pentagon missions to the moon. So in a moment, and it has been a long time, Richard C. Hoagland. Richard, I've looked very carefully, and all I see is rocks. Oh. Wait a minute. We're going to talk about bees.
We're going to come back to that at some point, I guess. Good evening, Art.
Yeah, good evening.
Or good morning, whatever the case may be.
More the case than not across the U.S., yes.
You have had many journeys, my friend.
That I have, he says.
Yes. Yes. Well, I am terrifically happy that we're doing this tonight because I think you're going to enjoy it. I think I'm going to enjoy it. And I think our audience definitely is going to enjoy it. In fact, they might want to record it. This might be one of those, you know, for the books.
Well, perhaps so. You're going to make a case, or you're going to try to make a case, that the bee mystery is somehow traces back to hyperdimensional physics, right?
I didn't start out from that position. I, like everybody else, have been kind of following this story, and I don't keep bees, and I don't know people that keep bees. And I've, you know, one of those, I mean, there's so much going on. This planet is going through such changes. I just listened to you with Evelyn, and it's marvelous that you have her on because she definitely does have her heart in the right place. And whoever that turkey was who made that stupid accusation should be ashamed of himself.
Well, you know, they couldn't make the accusation that she was inaccurate, so they're left to that.
Well, there are desperate people who really can't handle, is that old line from A Few Good Men, they can't handle the truth.
Right.
And we're dealing in a situation where there's a rising curve of changes in every direction. I mean, you called it, I don't know how you did it, you probably have sources, but
no.
You wrote a whole book called The Quickening.
Mm-hmm.
Pointing toward exactly what we're looking at now and what we're going to be seeing in a rising curve as we get closer to this nodal point, this date of 2012. And I there are times when I say to myself, how the heck did he know? Because when you and I started talking about stuff, which was, what, 10, 15 years ago?
Sure.
We were at the very beginning. You had to really have your radar way out there on the distant time horizon to note that life was not going on as it had been.
And intuition. Intuition, Richard. That's all it was. Intuition.
Well,
I felt it coming.
I mean, you're at the center of a spider web. If anybody in those years was going to get an early warning jiggle in the spider web, it would have been you.
Right.
Because you created this incredible experiment, this grand family, this, as Peter Jennings once called it, the national campfire. Of course, he wasn't talking about your show. He was talking about media in general during crises. And I think he was talking about ABC right after 9/11, but it applies so much more to what you and George do because, you know, the really bright people are awake now. They're up at night. They are night people. They are sensitive. They're able to look at other things minus the distractions of life. You know that old cliche, life is what happens when you're making plans?
That's right.
And it's those people who, in synchronization with you at the center of the spider web, were aware long before the rest of the culture that life would not go on as we have been used to life going on.
No, it will not.
And now we're seeing this ascending, almost asymptotic, almost right through the roof curve of change every day. When I get up, you know, which of course is not in the early morning anymore, you have ruined my life, Art. The first thing I do is I turn on, you know, MSNBC or CNN or whatever.
Oh, you become a night person.
Well, yeah, because it's also easier to work. When you're trying to do intellectual things, you're trying to think, when you're trying to figure out problems and put pieces together. And
much better at night.
The dots. The night. You know, I took a little walk outside here where we are in New Mexico, and it's a stunning night. There's brilliant Venus, and there's a, you know, we can see down the valley in twinkling lights and stars. And I mean, it's nighttime is when real thinking can be done. And that's where this vast coast to coast, I mean, think of yourself in space art, looking down at the planet and looking down at the entire United States from sea to shining sea, except of course, at night they don't shine. What's shining is all the lights of all those cities, representative of the consciousness of all the people who are listening to us right now, all connected. So the logical extension of you being in the center of the spider web was to use the web to do important things. I mean, you know my position, that I wouldn't be here talking to you if you hadn't used the spider web to benefit me.
And you were one of the, yeah, that's true.
A bunch of other stuff. And it's interesting what Evelyn said, because part of what I want to talk about this evening is how this physics that I have been discussing for so many years involves this consciousness field, this ability to link minds in a coherent, resonant fashion to accomplish extraordinary things. And as we get into this series of changes, as the years go by and more things happen that we don't want to see happen, I really think that this audience is going to have to basically shoulder the mantle of taking responsibility for trying to make positive change.
It may well come to that. Before you go on, Richard, I really miss Peter Jennings. As you know, I was in the last special that he did. And I'm convinced that had he lived, there would have been follow-ups. That was but a first tentative big step on the part of a network. And I think that he had plans to go further had he lived.
Well, it was a very peculiar special because it had elements for debunkers. But it also had areas that they focused on that if it had been just a simple rip and read show, they would not have focused on. And I saw it, like you, as a kind of an experimental toe in the water.
That's it.
To see who stood up and saluted, to mix our metaphors madly here. And he was taken away from us much, much too soon.
Yeah. There was no way that program, of course, was ever going to satisfy ufology. No way in the world. But it was not for that audience. It was for the larger audience. And it was a little baby step, and a good one. And I'm convinced he would have taken it farther. At any rate, we are now in the middle of a real mess. The number of bees missing.
Well, I've done a calculation, and, you know, the average commercial beekeeper, I found out a lot about bees in the last few weeks. I now know more about bees than I ever thought I would ever know in my entire life. The thing that's significant is the commercial bee people, and I didn't know this before I got into it. Beekeeping used to be a hobby. It used to be, you know, some folks that had a couple of hives or a farm. You know, I grew up in farm country, so I knew about people who kept bees. But it's turned into, as most other things in our society it's turned into a corporation.
Yeah.
It's turned into mass production. And they have, some of these beekeeping farms have literally thousands of hives. And each hive can contain between 20,000 and 80,000 bees, each in wooden enclosure. And when you start trucking these around the country and you have to feed them sugar water and you know, alternate food to get them from point A to point B, then they put them out on these farms so they will pollinate like the almond crop. And what was striking to me is that it was the mass-produced, domesticated, corporate bee that is suffering this stunning, catastrophic whatever first. And you made such a perceptive comment a few weeks ago as you began to notice the depth and severity of this.
Mm-hmm.
You asked one crucial question that really got me thinking, which was, where are all the little bee bodies?
That's right.
With their six legs sticking up in the air. And that was such an image. I mean, if you were to kill the bees in an average hive, you'd have 30, 40, 50,000 bodies.
Right.
Now, we have gone through previous, I found out, epidemics of bee disasters back in the 50s and the 70s. there were major waves of catastrophic bee die-offs, where the beekeepers would come out and they would find hives full of dead bees, bees stacked around the hives, dying
right.
of pesticides and the mites and the parasites that basically attack them. That's not what's going on with this crisis. This is so X-Files. This is so Chris Carter. This is so, if I may use the term, Star Trek. This is like Art. Someone basically said, Scotty, beam them up.
Yeah.
And they're all gone. And what's interesting and even weirder is that normally when hives have these problems, they're full of honey, right? And they're
Correct.
Full of little bees and pupae and larvae and, you know, the bee life cycle is going on. And so you've got this city of bees minus bees. If they abandon the hive, if they swarm and go away, leaving a few and the queen and all that, they will be attacked by predators in the surrounding ecosystem very quickly. There are worms and there are moths and there are little guys waiting to move in to that incredible rich source of energy, the honey, to basically eat it.
Yeah, one of my callers nailed it. He said it's like the bees have been raptured.
Exactly. It's beam me up, you know, Scotty. And what's weird is that the hives are not the focus of predators moving in to steal what's left when the workers are all away. They are left alone. Now, what other phenomenon in the phenomenology that you have covered all these years has the same earmarks of a, quote, eco-crime where predators do not move in to take advantage of the crime? Can you think of
that? Well, sure. For example, a cow that has been taken up and then dropped. Predators don't touch
cattle
it.
Cattle mutilations.
That's right.
Bingo. I knew you'd get it. Now, don't you find that parallel stunning?
Maybe. In other words, we don't have little bee bodies that are untouched by any sort of predators or anything of that sort.
No. The bees have just disappeared. Now, I also think that some of these swarms, I mean, we're putting up something on the web tonight. Soon as I can find my web guy, David Wilcock and I have been working this problem jointly. David is a brilliant guy in terms of physics. His intuition is matched only by his resourcefulness and his ability to do real research. Well, he has put together, and I have put together, this overview of a series we're putting up on Enterprise beginning tonight, which will be posted maybe sometime during the show, if not, then certainly tomorrow. And I was doing some tail-end work, and I started looking at some of the weird phenomenology around the edges of this mystery. We're finding a lot more bees showing up in strange places where bees have no business being, pun intended. Like a few days ago, they had a 60,000 bee swarm basically show up and camp out at City Hall in downtown Spokane, Washington. They had a similar group show up in a hospital in Little Rock, Arkansas. It would have been more interesting if it had been the Rose Law Firm, but they didn't do that. They went to the hospital. And what that's telling me, or at least it's potentially suggestive, is that the bees aren't dying, Art. They're lost.
They're lost, yeah.
They
a lot of people have suggested
find their
that.
Their way home.
That's right.
And what happens is two bees get together and say, hey, tell everybody, meet us in the corner of Elm and Central. Mm. And they all show up to try to do their normal bee thing, which is very social. You know, bees are incredibly social. And they want to get together. They can't live apart. I mean, I one of my musings was, I can imagine this little bee leaving the hive, the worker, going out to do its thing with the flowers and all that, and it can't get back. What does it do? How does it function, and for how long can it live all on its own? Well, if you take, for instance, one commercial carrier that I know had something like 27 million bees disappear in the space of a couple of days. Now, that sounds like a lot of bees, right?
Yeah.
But if you spread them out through several square miles, and think of the number of square feet there are in a square mile, it turns out that you wouldn't even notice the bees
perhaps
in that space, even millions of them. And globally, if we do a rough calculation, about a billion, more or less, give or take, bees have disappeared in the Northern Hemisphere between here
and Europe.
That's a lot of bees.
Richard, Einstein is quoted as saying that 4 years after the bees are gone, so will go humanity. What do you think he based that on?
Well, first of all, he never said it.
He didn't know.
That is an urban legend. Let me nail that one right to the floor right now. That is an interesting myth that's been going around. I don't know who coined it. It obviously was designed to get our attention. It got your attention because you used it several times.
Oh, yes.
How we know that it never happened is that there are some assiduous folks like at, website? Snopes. You know, looks up legends, urban legends.
Yes.
No one can find any references in any of Einstein's letters, papers, documents, public speeches to bees. Zero. None. Zip. Yes. Nada. He never said it. But the sentiment is, in fact, true. It's almost like somebody who knew that they could only get publicity if they used a famous name, put this out, and the net spread it, you know, all around the world. Without the bees, in our you know, ecosystem in the United States alone, it turns out that about a third of the food that we consume, particularly fruits and vegetables and apples and stuff like that, comes from bee pollination. If we lost the bees,
yes,
the domestic honeybee, the big commercial farms
disappear,
then our entire food chain will be extraordinarily negatively impacted. And it will ripple. It's not linear. It's not like, oh, well, I can live without apples. It's the subtleties. Remember, these are all interrelated systems, and you cannot predict a linear cause and effect if something of this magnitude takes hold. And at the moment, the only ray of good news, and this is something we'll obviously get into in the next half hour, is that the only honeybees, well, let me back up. The only bees that seem to be radically affected like this,
the wild ones,
are the corporate bees.
Corporate bees. I heard that organic bees are not disappearing now.
Not at all. And there was another clue. And, you know, we don't have time now between now and the bottom of the hour, but you know, as I promised tonight, I'm going to provide not only what the cause seems to be from our research, but what the solution can be. And the only problem is that the solution is going to require both sides, and there's two sides in this human equation, to come together and to make peace with each other, because they haven't for years. They've been fighting for years, political fights that I found out about in terms of doing this research. Mm. There are two camps, and they don't talk to each other. They each accuse the other of doing terrible things to bees and, you know, not using practices that are acceptable, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They're going to have to come together. These two sides, the commercial bee farmers and the organic bee farmers, are going to have to basically, you know, lay down the whatever you want to call it, the gauntlet, put down the gauntlet and come to the table and together craft a solution. Because it turns out the organic beekeepers, even though they don't know yet what they know something that will solve this crisis.
So they're going to have to form a hive mentality.
That's right. They will have to form a social system patterned on the little creatures that they live upon.
All right. Well, look, what's the difference between the way the organic bees are maintained and handled and the way the big corporate manipulators do what they do? In other words, therein has got to lie the answer.
Well, the first clue I had was in an article in The Economist, which is the first paper listed, or the first reference listed in our bee paper that will be posted, because The Economist made, again, I knew nothing about how bee stuff went on until I started researching, and what I found is that we have this incredible migratory corporate Henry Ford assembly line approach to where they truck millions of bees on big, you know, semis, flatbeds.
Right.
From farm to farm, and they truck them across half the country.
All
you
right.
will have a huge semi full of bees from Alabama going to the almond fields in California.
All right. We will be right back. Richard C. Hoagland is my guest. I'm Art Bell. Here I am indeed. Well, all right. I've heard the same thing. It's going around the internet. There are a lot of statements by organic bee handlers that organic bees are not affected. That said, the the big masses of them that, as Richard pointed out, are carried on semis around the country are affected. So I guess that begs a couple of questions. One that comes to mind immediately is, we've been doing that for years and years and years. If the bees were going to object to be being carted about by semis for commercial purpose, it seems to me they would have made that objection or that miscalculation or that inability to find home apparent years ago. What has changed? We'll be right back. All right, Richard, before you say anything, let me read this to you. United Press International, dated May 10th, a NASA study suggests that global warming may raise average summer temperatures in the eastern United States by 10 degrees Fahrenheit by the 2080s. National Aeronautics and Space Administration scientists determined that eastern U.S. summer daily high temperatures that currently average in the low to mid 80s Fahrenheit will most likely soar into the low to mid 90s by the 2080s. But during seasons with infrequent rainfall, July and August, daily temperatures could average between 100 and 110 degrees in cities like Chicago, Washington, and Atlanta. Now, that process is underway right now, Richard. Whatever it is that's causing it, the process is certainly underway. And perhaps the bees, as somebody emailed me at the beginning of the program, are already being affected by this, and they're going north. Just a thought, Richard.
That's an interesting idea. We should talk to Canada.
Well, it's funny you should mention that. That's where the email came from, was Alberta.
Interesting.
Where he said they've got bees all over the place.
Well, as I said, it was the article in The Economist that got me really thinking that we might have a you know, kind of a trek here on what could be going on, because this idea that the hives are trucked from state to state and farm to farm.
Right.
You know, it's hard enough to find your way home when you stay put. But can you imagine a little bee that uses environmental cues solely being trucked in covered hives, you know, thousands of miles, 2,000 miles, for instance, set out in the fields in a totally strange place if something were interfering with their navigation system?
Okay.
If something were changing the environment.
It'd have to be something recent, Richard,
absolutely,
because they've been doing this for years.
Absolutely. That's where the major clue comes in. So, you know, David and I and a couple other people that we're working with on this started comparing notes, and I said, you know, it's got to be what I've been saying all along, possibly a change in the physics. So I started doing bee research. I started looking up, you know, websites and looking at people who've been, you know, working with bees all their lives, who've done exquisite literature searches, who have massive databases on their sites going back literally hundreds of years to where bees were domesticated. I mean, you know, the domestic honeybee is not native. It comes from Europe. It was brought over in the 1600s. And it was first domesticated in Europe, and actually it was domesticated originally in Egypt. You know, we have data going back that far. And the practices have not really changed very much up until the last couple hundred years. A couple hundred years out of thousands of years that man has lived with bees.
Even so, that's a long time.
So I started looking at, well, what have we been doing? What beekeepers have been doing be in contradiction to what bees would like to be doing? Because this, this crucial piece of data that the natural bees, the wild, the feral bees they're called, as well as the organic bees that are raised by humans but under, quote, natural conditions, and we'll get into what that means in a minute, that they're unaffected by this. This is only affecting the what I call the corporate hives, the mass transit bees, the ones that are trucked around, and the ones that live in these, you know, artificial environments. What do they do? What do those guys do that the natural folks don't do? Well, the first thing I found out was that the corporate hives are dusted and fumigated and pesticided and basically sprayed within an inch of their lives.
Right.
And the reason is that in their corporate world, they are attacked by all kinds of outside parasites that are trying to devour them, trying to eat them, particularly the tracheal mites and this Sporola mite, which came in the 1950s, around 57, I think, from Asia. Those are the two biggest problems of the corporate domesticated bee mass production guys, is these exterior, basically parasites, attackers, that are trying to eat what's in the hive, including the bees. Mm-hmm. And the only way that those guys, you know, attack back is they use fungicides and pesticides and, you know, all kinds of techniques to basically try to keep the wrong guys out and the good guys' immune system supported, which, of course, is doing exactly the opposite.
And they are claiming that the immune system they feel is affected, right, of the bee?
Well, when they go to these hives, this is now the people at the University of Pennsylvania, who is one of the centers for this developing catastrophic response to this crisis, has originated. When they go to the hives where nobody's home except for a queen and a few workers and a lot of little bees that are still in the honeycomb about to be born, and they take bees out and they sample them, they find they're riddled with these parasites and disease. Now, they're claiming that maybe it's a parasitic thing. I've seen news stories that it's a viral thing. I saw, remember the news story that it was cell phones?
Cell phones, yeah, and sure, all kinds of things. Yeah.
From the study in Germany. Everybody has got their oar in the water here, and nobody really knows. You know, there's like the fad of the couple-day club, where a scientist or a group of scientists will come up and say, I have a friend call me tonight, who, by the way, her name is Lee, and she is having a birthday, so everybody wish Lee Chin a happy birthday. She called me with a study that she sent me from, I think, London, claiming that it's a genetically modified foods, that they're the culprit.
All right.
The problem is that the food source, the viral environment, the pesticide environment, the parasite environment, everything is the same art for the domestic bees, the feral bees, the organic bees, and the corporate bees.
But that's
only
what I thought.
The corporate I'm using that kind of over term because they're basically big companies that truck these things around. They're the ones radically suffering. So what is it that makes them the target when all the other bees eat the same food, are exposed to the same pests?
Yeah, and why now?
And
I
why
mean,
now?
They've been carted around like this for many years. So
you go back to what has changed in the environment that the corporate bees cannot withstand, and the natural bees and the organic domestic bees are withstanding perfectly fine.
Right.
And that's where the incredible aha, the light bulb went on. And it has to come back to the physics. Because I got deeper into this, I started realizing that it was, remember that line in when Clinton was running, is the economy stupid?
Mm-hmm.
It's the geometry stupid. Look at a beehive. Look at a honeycomb. What do you see? A honeycomb is composed of very regular cells that are hexagonal, right?
Correct.
And what is a hexagon? It's in two dimensions. It's two interlocked tetrahedrons.
Right.
And so I started thinking, okay, is there potentially a connection between bees disappearing, mites attacking them, honeycomb geometry, and you're going to love this one, the Great Pyramid?
Why? But honeycomb geometry is consistent whether they're organic or trucked about.
Ah, but it isn't. That's what I found. It's not. It's the same geometry, but what the corporate folks have done, and they basically done it out of the profit motive, to make the bee industry more productive, more successful, more above the bottom line versus below the bottom line, all that stuff. Starting a couple hundred years ago, they started turning out on machines what they call foundation, which is basically an artificial template where you have a machine that in a matrix, probably metal, it can be plastic now, they stamp out what's called foundation honeycomb.
Okay.
And the bees, they put this in these wooden structures, the hives, and the bees build their natural honeycomb with wax,
Right.
On this foundation. It's like
okay.
a temple.
I can understand how that would add to the bottom line, cut some time off the B building and all the rest of it, but
well, it's even more interesting.
But this has been going on for a couple hundred years, so why is it just showing up now?
Well, this is where things get really interesting. That's why, as part of our program tonight, I wanted to do some background on the physics and how the physics intersects with this problem slash solution. Mm-hmm. So it turns out that a couple hundred years ago, they started building this standard honeycomb, you know, putting it in the bees in the artificial farms, and the bees would build on it. They noticed that the honeycomb that they were making was bigger than the natural honeycomb of the wild bees. And then they noticed something even more intriguing, that bigger honeycomb seemed to beget bigger bees.
Mm-hmm.
Bigger bees have bigger legs, bigger wings. They can fly farther. They can forage better. They have more energy. They have longer proboscises, which are the tongues that dip into the nectar of the flower.
Right.
They can get at flowers that the little bees, the normal bees, as these guys saw it, couldn't get to. And the bottom line was they could produce, for a given number of bees, bigger bees, the theory was, would produce more honey, which you would then sell to make more money.
Sure.
Or okay. In terms of the pollination side, where the bees are basically trucked around not to make honey, but just to pollinate.
Right.
They would be able to pollinate more fields faster per day than the smaller bees, that kind of thing. So you could charge more for bigger bees.
Hmm.
It turns out that that's the source of the problem, Art.
Because?
Because the bigger combs are somehow deleterious. They're somehow having an incredible negative influence now on the bees themselves.
Why now?
And they leave.
Yeah, why now?
Well, that gets back to what is the honeycomb doing? Remember, our model, the model of the hyperdimensional physics, is that reality in three dimensions is immersed in this constant sea of invisible waves in the ether, mm-hmm. vibrating, sloshing back and forth, rippling out from rotating planets like little pebbles that you drop in a pond, whatever. And it's the interaction of all these various spinning masses. It's all rotation, all the way down to the atomic level, where okay. things are in constant spinning motion, right?
Yes.
And it's the geometry of the honeycomb which tends to amplify certain frequencies of this background field of invisible radiation. Now, I'm not talking electromagnetics. I'm not talking radio waves or whatever. I'm talking something even more fundamental that I discovered a couple of years ago as part of our ongoing research into how this physics worked. It turns out that there is a huge body of physics that's been hidden because of the Cold War from the West, where the Russians have done stunning, amazing, replicatable experiments, particularly one guy named Nicholas Kozarev we're going to talk about. And they're calling this whole field torsion field physics. Torsion is another word for spin and rotation. And when I got this data, which is on the web, and lots of papers that have not been translated that are in Russian that I would love to be able to read, but what's on there that has been translated was a stunning aha, because every experiment that I had thought of over the years to do to test the hyperdimensional model, it turns out the torsion field guys, starting with Nicholas Kozarev back in the 20s and 30s in the Stalinistic Soviet Union, had thought of and done. And when I got this data a couple of years ago, it was like a $10 million Christmas present. It was every experiment in hyperdimensional physics that Enterprise has never had the money to actually go out and be able to do. And it came to me by way of my dear friend, David Wilcock, who is a brilliant guy. I mean, he saw this relationship between the Russian work and what I've been talking about before I did, and brought it to my attention. And that's why we have wound up working together. In fact, you and I and he did a program in May of 2000, the night that Jean Mailoff was murdered, where we talked about this physics and the climate change, which is going on not just on Earth, but all over the solar system, which is mandated by this fundamental systemic change in this background physics, in this relationship of the torsion fields of various spinning planets and the sun, and it even impacts life. it turns out that this torsion physics applies to everything we can see. It's the glue that knits together reality, including, as Evelyn Pagnini was saying in the first hour, consciousness. It's what you basically are tinkering with, Art, when you do these mass consciousness experiments. You synchronize the minds of the millions of Coast people, the Coast family that is listening to us right now. You get them in resonance. You then direct that resonance in the torsion field to accomplish something. And through an actual measurable physics, and the experiments are stunning. They're absolutely stunning. They're so predictive. They so explain what's going on in so many areas that look like they're separate, but they're really not. They're really connected. And so I started thinking, okay, geometry, bees, bee sizes, the physics changes. Because of economics, the commercial beekeepers have built bigger combs that make bigger bees. And it turns out that these bigger combs are very unhealthy places for bees to live. The stunning difference between the natural wild bees and or the organic bee farmers that use much smaller comb size as their foundation, mm-hmm. and the commercial guys, is that the natural bees, the organic bees, don't have a mite problem, either the varroa or the trachea mites, which are the two banes of bee existence now in the last 30 or 40 years that are killing bees left and right, unless you use massive doses of pesticides and fungicides and all kinds of basically, you know, pest killers.
But the one question you have not asked or answered yet is, what has changed this year?
I think it is a frequency of the tone of the background physics that the combs, in fact, are amplifying. And I go back to what I said a moment ago about the Great Pyramid. Remember some years ago, I mean, you had a dozen people on talking about the Great Pyramid, and the one thing about the pyramid that everybody kind of agrees on is that, you know, 100 years ago, 200 years ago, somebody discovered dead cats were not decomposing in the pyramid.
I remember something about that.
They were getting in there, they were dying because they can't find their way out, and they have no food and water and all that, but they weren't decomposing. The reason, back engineering this, is that the frequency of the torsion field of the pyramid is such that it does not permit bacteria to live. It basically is a place where those life forms do not resonate. They are dissonant with the background field of the pyramid in the torsion model.
But this is nothing you can measure, is it?
Oh,
this
yes,
is
it
not
is.
An energy.
No, it is.
How?
It's because Kozarev built a whole bunch of detectors. David Wilcock has built detectors. You know, there's a very famous Russian guy that I don't have in front of me now. I will after the top of the hour, who did a whole bunch of experiments, it turns out, with bees, who wasn't part of the Russian torsion field physics community. He was a separate Russian guy who just was an entomologist. He was just into bees. And he discovered that there was a peculiar radiation that would even penetrate brick walls and structures and all that, whereby the bees were actually using this resonant honeycomb field effect to find their way home. And there are replicable experiments, Art, and they will all be in the series of papers we're putting up starting tonight or tomorrow, going through the coming week.
All right. Can you you say they've put together detectors that can detect whatever this energy is?
Yes.
Which should mean that you can tell me what kind of detectors they are and what kind of energy it is.
Yep. Okay. Well, I can't do it in 2 minutes. But...
Well, no, that's all right. You don't even have 2 minutes. All right, very good. My guest is Richard C. Hoagland, and he thinks he's got his thumb on the bee problem. It is true that organic bees are not affected. The ones carted about for the big industrial mid-farmland that we have and for pollination, these are the ones that are affected. We've learned that much. Richard thinks it has something to do with the construction of the hives and a new energy that we'll talk more about. We'll be right back.